Left 15 degrees rudder, McCafferty ordered quietly. Torpedo in the water, bearing 249. All ahead, 2/3. This order was loud. Con sonar, we got increased machinery noises on Sierra 1. Okay, the front contact is a 2-screw boat. Blade count indicates speed of 10 knots and increasing. Getting some cavitation. Target Sierra 1 is maneuvering. Classify this target as a Tango class. Boston's the one in back. All ahead, 1/3. McCafferty ordered his submarine to slow back down. Get him, Todd. His wish was rewarded with an explosion 15 seconds later. Sims had come up with the same tactic as his friend on Chicago. Close to a few thousand yards of the target and give him no chance to maneuver clear. 15 minutes later, Boston joined her healthy sister. Talk about a tough 4 hours. That tango was good, Sims called over on the Gertrude. You in good shape? Yes, we have the front guard position. You want to take the rear for a while? You got it, Danny. See ya. Iceland. Lead off, Sergeant Nichols. The Russian outpost was 3 miles south and 3,000 feet up. They climbed up the walls of the ravine and into relatively open ground. They were between the sun and the outpost. Edwards found that, intellectually, he believed what Nichols said about light conditions, and how the eye reacted to them, and how easy was it to spot something 3 miles away. But walking like this felt like being naked on the street at rush hour. They had darkened their faces with camouflage makeup, and their uniforms blended in well with the color and texture of the land. But the human eye looks for movement, Edwards told himself, and we're moving. What am I doing here? One step at a time. Walk softly. Don't raise any dust. Slow, easy pace. No sudden moves. Heads down. All the things Nichols had said echoed through his mind. Look at me. I'm invisible. He commanded himself not to look up, but Edwards would have been less than human not to sneak an occasional look. The hill, mountain, towered above them. It really got steep near the top. A volcano, he wondered. There was no sign of activity at the summit. Maybe nobody is there? Right. Do us all a favor and be blind, or asleep, or eating, or looking for airplanes. He had to pull his eyes away from it. The rocks he stepped over and around blended together after a while. Each member of the party walked alone. No one said anything. Every face was couched in a neutral expression that might have meant quiet determination or concealed exhaustion. Just walking the rock safely required concentration. This is the end of it, the last hike. The last hill to climb. The end, Edwards promised himself. After this, I drive a car to get the morning paper. If I can't have a one-story house, I'll damned well have an elevator installed. I'll get kids to cut the grass for me and sit on the porch watching them. Finally, the hilltop was behind him. He had to sneak his looks over his shoulder now. For some reason, the helicopter full of Russian paratroopers didn't come. They were somewhat safer now. So Nichols stepped up the pace. 4 hours later, the mountaintop was behind a knife-edge ridge of volcanic rock. Nichols called a halt. They'd been moving for 7 hours. Well, the sergeant said, that was easy enough, wasn't it? Sarge, next time you jump out of an airplane, please break your ankle, Mike suggested. Hard part's behind us. Now all we have left is to climb this wee hill, Nichols pointed out. Might want to get some water first, Smith said. He pointed to a stream 100 yards away. Good idea. Lieutenant, I do think we should be atop the hill as quick as we can. Agreed. This is absolutely the last goddamned hill I ever climb. Nichols chuckled. I have said that myself once or twice, sir. I don't believe it. USS Independence. Welcome aboard, Toland. Commander, Strike Fleet Atlantic, was a 3-star billet, but Rear Admiral Scott Jacobson would have to settle for the job instead of the rank for the moment. The lifelong aviator was the most senior carrier division commander in the Navy, and was the replacement for the late Admiral Baker. "You have one hell of a letter of introduction here from Admiral Beatty." "He made too big a deal of it. All I did was pass along an idea somebody else came up with." "Okay. You were on Nimitz when the task force got hit, right?" "Yes, sir, I was in CIC." "The only other guy who got out was Sonny Svensson?" "Captain Svensson, yes, sir." Jacobson picked up his phone and punched 3 digits. "Ask Captain Spaulding to join me. Thank you. Toland, you, me, and my operations officer are going to relive that experience. I want to see if there might be something our briefing left out. They're not going to punch any holes in my carrier, son."
"Admiral, don't underestimate them," Toland warned.
"I won't underestimate them, Toland. That's why I have you here. Your group got caught too far north for the circumstances. Taking Iceland was a beautiful move on their part. It screwed our plans pretty well. We are going to fix that, Commander."
"So I gather, sir."
USS Reuben James.
"Ain't she pretty?" O'Malley said.
He flipped his cigarette over the side and crossed his arms, staring at the massive carrier on the horizon. She was just a dim gray shape, with aircraft landing on the flat deck.
"My story is supposed to be about the convoy," Calloway sniffed.
"Well, they're making port right about now. End of story."
The pilot turned with a wide grin.
"Hell, you made me famous, didn't you?"
"You bloody aviators are all the same," the Reuters correspondent snapped angrily. "The captain won't even tell me where we're going."
"You don't know?" O'Malley asked in surprise.
"Well, where are we going?"
"North."
Le Havre, France. The port had been cleared in expectation of the convoy. The merchantmen were brought past several wrecks of ships that had died from Soviet mines, some laid before the war, others dropped from aircraft. The port had also been bombed 6 times by long-range fighter bombers, each time at a murderous price from French air defense forces. The first ships in were the big Ro-Ros, the roll-on-roll-off container ships. 8 of them together carried a full armored division, and these were taken quickly to the Bassin Théophile du Croc. One by one, the ships lowered their curved stern ramps to the dock, and the tanks began to roll off. They met a continuous taxi rank of low-loader tractor trailers, each of which would carry a tank or other armored fighting vehicle to the front lines. Loaded, they rolled off one by one to the assembly point at the Renault facility adjacent to the port. It would take hours to unload the division, but it had been decided nevertheless to move everything in a body to the fighting front, less than 500 kilometers away. After what had seemed an endless, tense voyage, arrival was a culture shock for the American troops, many of them National Guardsmen who rarely went overseas. The dock workers and traffic police were too exhausted from weeks of frantic work to show any human emotion, but ordinary people who had learned, despite heavy security, that reinforcing troops were landing, came out, first in small groups, soon in small mobs, to watch the new arrivals. The American troops were not allowed to leave their company areas. After some informal negotiations, it was decided small delegations would be allowed to meet briefly with some of the troops. The security risk was minor. The telephone lines in and out of all NATO ports were under tight control. And there was an unexpected result to this exercise in simple courtesy. Like their fathers and grandfathers, the arriving troops saw that Europe was worth fighting for. The people who were often seen merely as threats to American jobs had faces and hopes and dreams, all of which were in danger. They were not fighting for a principle or a political decision or a treaty made of paper. They were here for these people and others not the least different from those they'd left at home. It took 2 hours longer than they'd hoped. Some vehicles were broken down, but the port and police officials had organized the assembly points with skill. The division moved off in the early afternoon at a steady 50 kilometers per hour, driving down a multi-lane highway cleared for its path. Every few yards, someone stood to wave while the troops made final checks on their gear. The easy part of their journey was about to end. Iceland. It was 4 in the morning when they reached the top, only to find that this mountain had a number of tops. The Russians had the highest one, 3 miles away. Edwards's group had a choice of 2 subsidiary peaks, each a few hundred feet lower than the adjacent 1,000-meter summit. They picked the higher of the two, overlooking the small fishing port of Stykkisholmur, almost due north, and the large rock-filled bay that the map called Hvammsfjörður.
"Looks like a fine observation point, Lieutenant Edwards," Nichols judged.
"That's good, Sarge, 'cause I am not going another foot."
Edwards already had his binoculars on the eastern peak.
"I don't see any movement."
"They're there," Nichols said.
"Yeah," Smith agreed, "sure as hell."
Edwards slid down from the crest line and unpacked his radio. "Doghouse, this is Beagle, and we are where you want us, over."
"Give me your exact position."
Edwards opened his map and read off the coordinates.
"We believe there's a Russian observation post on the next peak over. They're about 5 clicks away, according to this map. We're well concealed here, and we have food and water for 2 days. We can see the roads leading into Stykkisholmur. Matter of fact, it's nice and clear now, and we can see all the way to Keflavik. We can't pick anything out, but we can see the peninsula."
"Very well. I want you to look north and tell us what you see in detail." Edwards handed the radio antenna to Smith, then turned and put his field glasses on the town. "Okay. The land is pretty flat, but higher than the water, on a shelf-like. The town is fairly small, maybe 8 square blocks. There are some little fishing boats tied up to the docks. I count 9 of them. The harbor north and east of the port is wall-to-wall rocks that go on for miles. I do not see any armored vehicles, no obvious signs of Russian troops. Wait, I do see 2 4x4s parked in the middle of the street-like, but nobody around them. The sun's still low and there's lots of shadows. Nothing moving on the roads. I guess that's about it."
"Very well, Beagle. Good report. Let us know if you see any Soviet personnel at all. Even 1. We want to know about him. Stay put."
"Somebody coming to get us?"
"Beagle, I don't know what you're talking about."
USS Independence. Toland stood in the Combat Information Center, watching the displays. Submarines concerned him the most. 8 Allied subs were in the Denmark Strait, west of Iceland, forming a barrier that few submarines would be able to pass. They were supported by Navy Orions operating out of Sondrestrom, Greenland, something impossible until the Russian fighters at Keflavik had been whittled down. That closed off one possible avenue of access to Strike Fleet Atlantic. More submarines formed a line parallel to the fleet's line of advance, and those were supported by the carrier-borne S-3A Vikings that operated continuously off the flight decks. The Pentagon had leaked to the press that this Marine division was en route to Germany, where the battle hung in the balance. In fact, the tight formation of amphibs was 20 miles from his carrier on a course of 039, 400 miles from its real objective. USS Reuben James.
"We're not heading north any longer," Calloway said.
Dinner was being served in the wardroom. The officers were plowing through the last fresh lettuce aboard.
"I believe you're right," O'Malley agreed. "I think we're heading west now."
"You might as well tell me what the devil we're up to. I've been shut off from your satellite transmitters."
"We're screening the Nimitz battle group, except that when you're motoring along at 25 knots, it's not all that easy."
O'Malley didn't like this. They were running a risk.
It was part of war, but the pilot didn't like any part of war, especially risks.
"They pay me to do it,
not to like it.
The escort is mostly British, isn't it?
Yeah, so?
That's a story I can use to tell the people at home how important.
Now look, Mr. Calloway, let's say you file your story and it got published in the local papers.
Then let's say a Soviet agent reads the story and passes it along to...
How would he do that? The government has undoubtedly put severe restrictions on all forms of communication.
Ivan has lots of communication satellites, same as us. We have 2 satellite transmitters on this dinky little frigate. You've seen them.
How expensive do they look?
Think maybe you could have one in your backyard, inside a bush, maybe?
Besides, the whole group is blacked out. Total MCON. Nobody is transmitting anything at the moment.
Morris arrived and took his seat at the head of the table.
"Captain, where are we going?" Calloway asked.
"I just found out. Sorry, I can't tell you. Battleaxe and we will continue to work together for a while as stern guard for the Nimitz group. We are now designated Mike Force."
"We getting any more help?" O'Malley asked.
"Bunker Hill is heading this way. She had to reload her magazines and join up with HMS Illustrious. They'll operate in close when they catch up. We're going to outside picket again. We start doing real ASW work in another 4 hours. Still going to be a bastard trying to keep up with the carrier, though."
USS Chicago. There were 3 contacts. All arrived within 10 minutes. 2 were ahead of Chicago, left and right of her bow. The 3rd was on her port beam. Somehow, McCafferty realized the Russians knew of the submarines they had killed. Probably some sort of radio boy, he was sure. That meant all that his tactical successes had really accomplished was to draw more dangers in on the trio of American submarines.
"Khan, sonar. We have some sonoboy signals at 266. Count 3 buoys. 4. Make it 4.
More bears? McCafferty wondered. A cooperative hunt?
"Skipper, you better come forward," the sonar chief called.
"What's happening?"
The waterfall display screen was suddenly crowded.
"Sir, we have 3 lines on sonoboys forming up right now. Got to be at least 3 aircraft up there. This one's fairly close. Looks like it'll extend aft of us, maybe right on our friends."
McCafferty watched the new signal lines appear at the rate of 1 per minute. Each was a Russian sonoboy, and the line marched east as 2 others grew on different azimuths.
"They're trying to box us in, Chief."
"Looks that way, sir."
"Every time we destroyed a Russian ship, we gave them a location reference. They've confirmed our course and speed of advance many times over." McCafferty had gotten his submarine back to the Sviataya Anatrof. His path to the ice pack was 100 miles wide and 300 fathoms deep. But how many Russian subs were there? The sonar crew continued to call off bearings to the submarine contacts while the captain watched the buoy lines extend.
"I think this is Providence, sir. She just increased speed."
"Yeah, look at the noise now. She's really increased speed. This buoy must be right near her.
Still can't find Boston, though."
Bearing was constant to the 2 forward submarine contacts. He couldn't develop a range figure unless he or they maneuvered. If he turned left, he'd then close on a 3rd contact, which might not be a good idea. If he turned right, he'd run away from the submarine that might then close on Providence. If he did nothing, he'd accomplish nothing. But McCafferty didn't know what to do.
"There's another buoy, sir."
The new one was between the bearings of 2 existing contacts. They were trying to localize Providence.
"There's Boston. She's running past a buoy."
A new contact line appeared suddenly bright where nothing had been before. Todd just increased power, and he's going to allow himself to be picked up, McCafferty thought. Then he'll dive deep to evade.
"Look at it from the Russian side," the captain told himself. "They don't really know what they're up against, do they? They probably figure they're up against more than one, but how many more? They can't know that. So they'll want to flush the game before they shoot, just to see what's here."
"Torpedo in the water, bearing 193.
A Russian bear had dropped on Boston. McCafferty watched the sonar display as Sims took his boat deep with the torpedo in pursuit. He'd change depth and make a few radical changes in course and speed, trying to evade the fish. The bright line of a noisemaker appeared, holding a constant bearing as Boston maneuvered further. The torpedo chased the noisemaker, running another 3 minutes before it ran out of fuel. The screen was relatively clear again. The sonoboy signals remained. Boston and Providence had reduced power and disappeared. But so had the Russian sub-signals. "What are they doing? What is their plan?" the captain asked himself. "What submarines are out there?" "Tangos. Has to be Tangos." They cut their electric motors back, slowed to steerage way, and that's why they disappeared off the scopes. "Okay, they're not coming in after us anymore." They stopped moving when the aircraft detected Providence and Boston. "They're coordinating with the bears. That means they have to be at shallow depth, and their sonar performance is down because they're close to the surface." "Chief, assume that these two contacts you had were Tangos doing about 10 knots. The figure of merit gives us a detection range of what?" "These water conditions, 10 to 12 miles. I'd be real careful using that number, sir." Three more sonoboy lines began to appear north of Chicago. McCafferty went aft to see how they were plotted out. They assumed about a 2 mile spacing on the sonoboy lines, and that gave them range figures. "Not being very subtle, are they?" the exec observed. "Why bother when you don't have to? Let's see if we can pick our way through the boys." "What are our friends doing?" "They'd better be coming north, too. I don't want to think about what other assets they have moving in on us. Let's head right through here." The executive officer gave the orders. Chicago began to move forward again. Now they'd really find out if the rubber tiles on the hull absorbed sonar waves or not. The last bearings to the Russian submarines were plotted also. McCafferty knew that they too could be moving behind that wall of noise. When he detected them again, it would be at perilously close range. They went deep. The submarine dove to 1,000 feet and cruised toward the precise midpoint between a pair of pinging buoys. Another torpedo appeared in the water aft, and McCafferty maneuvered quickly to evade, only to realize that it was aimed at someone else, or nothing at all. They listened to it run for several minutes, then fade out. A perfect way to break a man's concentration, McCafferty thought, bringing his sub back to a northerly course. Bearings to the sonoboys changed as they got closer. They were almost exactly 2 miles apart, a mile on either beam, as Chicago went through the first line, crawling just above the bottom. They were set on a frequency that could be heard clearly through the hull. "Just like the movies," the captain thought, as the crewman, not directly involved in navigating the boat, looked up and outward at the hull, as though it were being caressed by the noise. Some caress. The second line was 3 miles beyond the first. Chicago turned slightly left to head for another gap. Speed was down to 4 knots now. Sonar called out a possible contact to the north that immediately faded away. Maybe a Tango, maybe nothing. It was plotted anyway, as the submarine took nearly an hour to reach the second line of pinging buoys. "Torpedo in the water, port side!" sonar screamed out. "Right full rudder, all ahead, flank!" Chicago's propeller thrashed at the water, creating a bonanza of noise for the Russian aircraft who dropped a fish on a possible contact. They ran for 3 minutes while waiting for additional data on the torpedo. "Where's the torpedo?" "It's pinging, sir. But it's pinging the other way, bearing changing south, left to right, and weakening." "All ahead, one-third. Rudder amidships," McCafferty ordered. "Another one, torpedo in the water bearing 046. "Right full rudder, all ahead flank," McCafferty ordered yet again. He turned to the exec. "You know what they just did? They dropped a fish to spook us into moving. Damn!" "Beautiful tactic, whoever you are. You know we can't afford to ignore a torpedo. But how'd they know we were here?"
Maybe they just guessed well. Maybe they got a twitch. Then we gave them the contact.
Torpedo bearing 041. The torpedo is pinging at us. Don't know if it has us, sir.
Captain, I got a new contact bearing 095. Sounds like machinery noises. Possible submarine.
Now what? McCafferty whispered.
He put the Russian torpedo on his stern and hugged the bottom. Sonar performance dropped to zero as Chicago accelerated past 20 knots. Their instruments could still hear the ultrasonic pings of the torpedo, however, and McCafferty maneuvered to keep the weapon behind him as it dove down after the American sub.
Bring her up. Make your depth 100 feet. Shoot off a noisemaker.
Full rise on the planes!
The diving officer ordered a short blow on the forward trim tanks to effect the maneuver. Along with the noisemaker, it created an enormous disturbance in the water. The torpedo raced in after it, missing below Chicago. A good maneuver, it was also a desperate one. The submarine rose quickly, her elastic hull popping as the pressure on the steel diminished. There was an enemy sub out there, and he now had all sorts of noise from Chicago. All McCafferty could do was run. He was confident that the other sub would chase after him with a homing torpedo circling below, but didn't understand why the other sub was there at all. He slowed Chicago to 5 knots and turned as the torpedo ran out of fuel below him. Next problem. There was a Soviet submarine close by.
He's got to know about where we are, Skipper.
You got that one right, XO. Sonar Khan. Yankee search.
Both sides could use unusual tactics.
Fire control party, stand by. This one's going to be a snapshot.
The powerful but seldom used active sonar installed in Chicago's bow blasted the water with low-frequency energy.
Contact, bearing 086, range 4600.
Set it up. Chicago's steel hull reverberated 3 seconds later with Soviet sonar waves.
Set. Ready for tubes 3 and 2.
Match bearings and shoot.
The torpedoes were fired within seconds of one another.
Cut the wires. Take her down. Make your depth 1,000 feet, all ahead flank, left full rudder. Come to new course 265.
The submarine wheeled and sped west as her torpedoes raced toward their target.
Transients, torpedoes in the water aft, bearing 085.
Patience, McCafferty said.
You didn't expect us to do that, did you?
Nice job, fire control. We got our shots off a minute faster than the other guy. Speed?
24 knots and increasing, sir, the helmsman answered.
Passing 400 feet, sir.
Sonar, how many fish we got chasing us?
At least 3, sir.
Sir, our units are pinging. I believe they have the target.
XO, in a few seconds, we're going to turn and change depth. When we do, I want you to fire off 4 noisemakers at 15-second intervals.
Aye, Cap'n.
McCafferty went over to stand behind the helmsman. He'd just turned 20 the day before. The rudder indicator was amidships, with 10 degrees of down angle on the planes, and the submarine was just passing through 500 feet and hurtling down. The speed log now showed 30 knots. The rate of acceleration slowed as Chicago neared her maximum speed. He patted the boy on the shoulder.
Now, 10 degrees rise on the planes and come right, 20 degrees rudder.
Yes, sir.
The hull thundered with the news that their fish had found their target. Everyone jumped or cringed. They had their own problems chasing after them. Chicago's maneuver left a massive knuckle in the water that the executive officer punctuated with 4 noisemakers. The small gas canisters filled the disturbance with bubbles that made excellent sonar targets while Chicago sped north. She raced right under us on a buoy, but the Russians could not put another torpedo down for fear of interfering with those already running.
"Bearing is changing on all contact, sir," sonar reported.
McCafferty started to breathe again.
"Ahead 1/3.
The helmsman dialed the annunciator handle. The engineers responded at once, and again Chicago slowed.
"We'll try to disappear again. They probably aren't sure yet who killed who.
We'll use that time to get back down to the bottom and crawl northeast.
Well done, people. That was sort of hairy.
The helmsman looked up.
Skipper, the south side of Chicago ain't the baddest part of town anymore.
Sure as hell is the tiredest, though, the captain thought. They can't keep coming at us this way. They have to back off and rethink, don't they? He had the chart memorized. Another 150 miles to the ice pack. Chapter 39 The Shores of Stikisholmer. Hunzen, Federal Republic of Germany. They'd finally defeated the counterattack. No, Alexeyev told himself. We didn't defeat it, we drove it off. The Germans had withdrawn of their own accord after blunting half of the Russian attack. There was more to victory than being in possession of the battlefield. It only got harder. Beregovoy had been right when he'd said that coordinating a large battle on the move was much harder than doing it from a fixed command post. Just the effort of getting the right map opened inside a cramped command vehicle was a battle against time and space, and 80 kilometers of front made for too many tactical maps. The counterattack had forced the generals to move one of their precious A-reserve formations north, just in time to watch the Germans withdraw after savaging the rear areas of 3 B motor rifle divisions, and spreading panic throughout the thousands of reservists who were trying to cope with old equipment and barely remembered training.
"Why did they pull back?" Sergeyev asked his general.
Alexeyev did not respond. There was a fine question that he had already asked half a dozen times. There were probably 2 reasons, he told himself. First, they'd lacked the strength to pursue the effort, and had had to settle for a spoiling attack to unbalance our operation. Second, the central axis of our attack was on the verge of reaching the Weser, and they might have been called back to deal with this possible crisis. The Army Group Intelligence Officer approached.
"Comrade General, we have a disturbing report from one of our reconnaissance aircraft."
The officer related the sketchy radio message from a low-flying, recce aircraft. NATO's control of the air had brought particularly grim losses to those all-important units. The pilot of this MiG-21 had seen and reported a massive column of Allied armor on the E-8 highway south of Osnabrück before disappearing. The general immediately lifted the radio phone to Stendhal.
"Why were we not informed of this as soon as you received it?" Alexeyev demanded of his superior.
"It is an unconfirmed report," Sinquest replied.
"Damn it, we know the Americans landed reinforcements at Le Havre."
"And they can't be at the front for at least another day. How soon will you have a bridgehead on the Weser?"
"We have units on the river now at Rula."
"Then move your bridging units there and get them across."
"Comrade, my right flank is still in disarray, and now we have this report of a possible enemy division forming up there."
"You worry about crossing the Weser, and let me worry about this phantom division." "That's an order, Pavel Leonidovich."
Alexeyev set the phone back in its place. "He has a better overall picture of what's going on," Pasha told himself. "After we bridge the Weser, we have no really serious obstacle in front of us for over 100 kilometers. After the River Weser, we can race into the Ruhr, Germany's industrial heart. If we destroy that, or even threaten it, then perhaps the Germans will seek their political solution, and the war is won. That is what he is telling me." The general looked at his maps. Soon the lead regiment would try to force men across the river at Rula. A bridging regiment was already en route. And he had his orders. "Start moving the OMG troops."
"But our right flank," Beregovoy protested.
"We'll have to look after itself." Brussels, Belgium. Sackyor was still worried about his supplies. He'd also been forced to gamble in giving highest transport priority to the armored division now approaching Springa. The container ships, loaded with munitions, spare parts, and the millions of other specialty items, were just now sending their cargoes to the front. His largest reserve formation, the tank force, was about to team up with 2 German brigades, and what was left of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, once a brigade in all but name,
now only two battalions of weary men. His supply situation was still tenuous. Many of his line units were down to 4 days of consumable stores, and the resupply effort would take 2 days, even if things went perfectly. A thin margin that in a pre-war exercise might have seemed equitable enough, but not now, when men and nations were at stake. Yet what choice did he have? "General, we have a report here of a regiment-sized attack on the Weser. It looks like Ivan's trying to put troops on the left bank." "What do we have there?" "One battalion of Landwehr, and they're pretty beat up. There are two companies of tanks on the way, ought to be there in a little over an hour. There are preliminary indications that Soviet reinforcements are heading that way. This might be the main axis of their attack. At least it seems that they're orienting in that direction." Sakyur rocked back in his chair, looking up at the map display. He had one reserve regiment within 3 hours of Rula. The general was a man who loved to gamble. He was never happier than when sitting at a table with a deck of cards and a few $100 worth of chips. He usually won. If he attacked south from Springa and failed, the Russians would put 2 or 3 divisions across the Weser, and he had precisely 1 regiment in reserve to stand in their way. If he moved his new tank division there, and by some miracle they got there in time, he would have frittered away his best chance for a counterattack by reacting to a Soviet move again. No, he couldn't just react anymore. He pointed to Springa. "How long before they're ready to move?" "The whole division? 6 hours at best. We can divert the unit still on the road south to..." "No." "Then we go south from Springa with what's ready now?" "No." Sakyur shook his head and outlined his plan. "Iceland."
"I see one," Garcia called.
Edwards and Nichols were beside him in a moment.
"Hello, Ivan," Nichols said quietly.
Even with binoculars, the distance was still a little over 3 miles. Edwards saw a tiny figure walking along the crest of the mountain top. He carried a rifle and appeared to be wearing a soft hat, perhaps a beret, instead of a helmet. The figure stopped and brought his hands up to his face. He had binoculars too, Edwards saw. He looked north, slightly downward, training his field glasses left to right and back again. Then he turned and looked off in the direction of Keflavik. Another man appeared, approaching the first. Perhaps they were talking, but it was impossible to tell at this distance. The one with binoculars pointed at something to the south.
"What do you suppose this is all about?" Edwards asked.
"Talking about the weather, girls, sports, food. Who knows?" Nichols replied. "Another one." The third figure appeared, and the trio of Russian paratroopers stood together doing whatever it was that they were doing. One had to be an officer, Edwards decided. He said something, and the others moved off quickly, dropping out of sight below the crest. "What order did you just give?" Presently a group of men appeared. The light was bad, and they shuffled around too much to get an accurate count. But there had to be at least 10. About half of them were carrying their personal weapons, and these started moving downhill. To the west.
"Right, he's a smart soldier," Nichols announced. "He's sending out a patrol to make certain the area is secure."
"What do we do about it?" Edwards asked.
"What do you think, Lieutenant?"
"Our orders are to sit tight. So we sit tight and hope they don't see us."
"Not likely they will, you know. I shouldn't think they'd climb down. Must be 800 feet. Then cross that rock yard, then climb up here just to see if any Yanks are about. Remember, the only reason we know they're there is that we saw their helicopter.
Otherwise we might have walked right into them, and that would have been that," Edwards reminded himself. "I won't be safe until I'm back home in Maine."
"Is that more of them?"
"Must be at least a platoon over there.
This is rather clever of our friends, isn't it?"
Edwards got on the radio to report this development to Doghouse while the Marines kept track of the Russians.
"A platoon?"
"That's Sergeant Nichols's estimate.
Kind of hard to count heads from 3 miles away, fella.
Okay, we'll pass that one along.
Any air activity?
Haven't seen any aircraft at all since yesterday.
How about Stickies Homer?
Too far to make anything out.
We still can see those 4x4s sitting in the street, but no armored vehicles. I'd say they had a small garrison force there to keep an eye on the port. The fishing boats aren't going anywhere.
Very well. Good report, Beagle. Hang in there.
The major switched off and turned to his neighbor at the communications console.
It's a shame to keep them in the dark like this, isn't it?
The SOE man sipped at his tea.
It would be a greater shame to blow the operation.
Edwards didn't take the radio apart, but left it leaning against a rock. Vigdis was still asleep on a flat ledge 20 feet below the top. Sleep was about the most attractive thing Edwards could think of at the moment.
"They're heading in this direction," Garcia said.
He handed the glasses to Edwards. Smith and Nichols were conferring a few yards away. Mike trained the binoculars on the Russians. He told himself that to have them come right to his position was a very low order of probability.
Keep telling yourself that.
He shifted his glasses to the Russian observation post.
"There it is again," the sergeant told his lieutenant.
"What's that?"
"I saw a flash from that hilltop. Sun reflected off something."
"A shiny rock," the lieutenant snorted, not taking the time to look.
"Comrade lieutenant!"
The officer turned at the sharp tone to see a rock flying through the air at his face. He caught it and was too surprised to be angry.
"How shiny does that rock look?"
"An old can, then. We found enough trash here from tourists and mountain climbers, haven't we?"
"Then why does it come and go and come back?"
The lieutenant got visibly angry at last.
"Sergeant, I know you have a year's combat experience in Afghanistan. I know I am a new officer. But I am a goddamned officer, and you are a goddamned sergeant."
The wonders of our classless society, the sergeant thought, continuing to look at his officer. Few officers could bear his look.
"Very well, sergeant. You tell them."
The lieutenant pointed at the radio.
"Markovsky, before you come back, check out the hilltop to your right."
"But it's 200 meters high," the squad leader shot back.
"Correct. It shouldn't take long at all," the platoon sergeant said comfortingly.
USS Independence. Tolan switched view graphs in the projector. "Okay, these satellite shots are less than 3 hours old. Ivan has 3 mobile radars, here, here, and here. He moves them about daily, meaning that one's probably been moved already, and usually has 2 operating around the clock. At Keflavik, we have 5 SA-11 launch vehicles, 4 birds per vehicle. This, Sam, is very bad news. You've all been briefed on its known capabilities, and you'd better figure on a few hundred handheld SAMs, too. The photo shows 6 mobile anti-aircraft guns. We don't see any fixed ones. They're there, gentlemen. They're just camouflaged.
At least 5, perhaps as many as 10 MiG-29 fighter interceptors. This used to be a regiment until the guys from Nimitz cut them down to size. Remember that the ones who are left are the ones who survived 2 squadrons of Tomcats. That is the opposition at Keflavik.
Toland stepped aside while the wing operations officer went over the mission profile. It sounded impressive to Toland. He hoped it would be so for the Russians. The curtain went up 50 minutes later. The first aircraft launched for the strike were the E-2C Hawkeyes. Accompanied by fighters, they flew to within 80 miles of the Icelandic coast and radiated their own radar coverage all over the formation. More Hawkeyes reached farther out to cover the formation from possible air and submarine-launched missile attack. Keflavik, Iceland. Ground-based Soviet radar detected the Hawkeyes even before their powerful systems went active. They could see 2 of the slow propeller-driven aircraft hovering beyond SAM range,
each accompanied by two other aircraft whose extended figure-8 course tracks denoted them as Tomcat interceptors guarding the Hawkeyes. The alarm was sounded. Fighter pilots boarded their aircraft while missile and gun crews raced to their stations. The Fighter Force commander was a major with 3 kills to his credit, but who had learned the virtue of caution the hard way. He'd been shot down once already. The Americans had sprung one trap on his regiment, and he had no wish to participate in a second. If this was an attack and not a feint to draw out what fighters remained on Iceland, how would he know? He reached his decision. On the major's command, the fighters lifted off, climbed to 20,000 feet, and orbited over the peninsula, conserving their fuel and remaining over land, where they could be supported by friendly SAMs. They had exercised carefully the previous few days with these tactics, and were as confident as they could be that the missile crews could distinguish between friendly and unfriendly aircraft. When they got to altitude, their radar threat receivers told them of more American Hawkeyes to the east and west. The information was relayed home with a request for a strike by the backfires. What they got back was a request to identify the American fleet's location and composition. The airbase commander didn't bother forwarding that. The Soviet fighter commander swore under his breath. The American radar aircraft were prime targets, and tantalizingly within reach. With a full regiment, he'd streak after them and risk losses from their fighter escorts. But he was sure that that was precisely what the Americans were hoping he'd do. The intruders went in first, skimming above the wavetops from the south at 500 knots, standard arm missiles hanging from their wings. More Tomcat fighters were behind them at high altitude. When the fighters passed the radar aircraft, they illuminated the circling MiGs with their radars and began to fire off Phoenix missiles. The MiGs couldn't ignore them. The Soviet fighters separated into two plane elements and scattered, coached from their ground-based radar controllers. The intruders popped up at a range of 30 miles, just outside the range of the SAMs, and loosed 4 standard arm missiles each, which homed in on the Russian search radars. The Russian radar operators faced a cruel choice. They could leave their search radars on and almost certainly have them destroyed, or turn them off and lessen the chance, and completely lose track of the overhead air battle. They chose a middle ground. The Soviet SAM commander ordered his men to flip their systems on and off at random intervals, hoping to confuse the incoming missiles while keeping tenuous coverage of the incoming strike. The missile flight time was just over a minute, and most of the radar crews took the time to switch their systems off and leave them off, each misunderstanding the order in the most advantageous manner. The Phoenixes arrived first. The MiG pilots suddenly lost their ground control guidance but kept maneuvering. One aircraft had 4 missiles targeted, and evaded 2 missiles, only to blunder into another one. The major in command swore at his inability to hit back as he tried to think of something that would work. Next came the standard arms. The Russians had 3 air search radars and 3 more for missile acquisition. All had been turned on when the first alarm sounded. Then all had gone black after the missiles had been detected in the air. The standards were only partially confused. Their guidance systems had been designed to record the position of a radar in case it did go off the air, and they homed in on those positions now. The missiles killed 2 transmitters entirely and damaged 2 others. The American mission commander was annoyed. The Russian fighters were not cooperating. They hadn't come out even when the intruders had popped up. He'd had more fighters waiting low for that eventuality. But the Soviet radars were down. He gave the next order. 3 squadrons of F-A-18 Hornets streaked in low from the north. The Russian air defense commander ordered his radars back on, saw that no more missiles were in the air, and soon picked up the low-flying Hornets. The MiG commander saw the American attack aircraft next, and with them his chance. The MiG-29 was a virtual twin to the new American aircraft. The Hornets sought out the Russian SAM launchers and began to launch their guided missiles at them. Missiles crisscrossed the sky. 2 Hornets fell to missiles, 2 more to guns, as the American fighter bombers scoured the ground with bombs and gunfire.
Then the MiGs arrived. The American pilots were warned, but were too close to their bombing targets to react at once. Once free of their heavy ordnance, they were fighters again, and climbed into the sky. They feared MiGs more than missiles. The resulting air battle was a masterpiece of confusion. The two aircraft would have been hard to distinguish sitting side by side on the ground. At 600 knots, in the middle of battle, the task was almost impossible, and the Americans, with their greater numbers, had to hold fire until they were sure of their targets. The Russians knew what they were attacking, but they too shrank from shooting with abandon at a target that looked too much like a comrade's aircraft. The result was a swarming mix of fighters closing to a range too short for missiles, as pilots sought positive target identification. An anachronistic gun duel punctuated by surface-to-air missiles from the two surviving Russian launchers. Controllers on the American aircraft and the Russian ground station never had a chance to direct matters. It was entirely in the hands of the pilots. The fighters went to afterburner and swept into punishing high-G turns, while heads swiveled and eyes squinted at familiar shapes while trying to decide if the paint scheme was friendly or not. That part of the task was fairly even. The American planes were haze gray and harder to spot, allowing easier target identification at long range than at short. Two Hornets died first, followed by a MiG. Then another MiG fell to cannon fire, and a Hornet to a snapshot missile. An errant Sam exploded a MiG and a Hornet together. The Soviet major saw that and screamed for the Sams to hold fire. Then he fired his cannon at a Hornet blazing across his nose, missed, and turned to follow him. He watched the American close for a high deflection shot on a MiG-29 and damage its engine. The major didn't know how many of his aircraft were left. It was beyond that. He was engaged in a struggle for personal survival, which he expected to lose. Caution faded to nothing as he closed on afterburner and ignored his low-fuel state light. His target turned north and led him over the water. The major fired his last missile and then watched it track right into the Hornet's right engine as his own engines flamed out. The Hornet's tail fragmented, and the major screamed with delight as he and the American pilot ejected a few hundred meters apart. 4 kills, the major thought. At least I have done my duty. He was in the water 30 seconds later. Commander Davies crawled into his raft despite a broken wrist, cursing and blessing his luck at the same time. His first considered action was to activate his rescue radio. He looked around and saw another yellow raft a short distance away. It wasn't easy paddling with one arm, but the other guy was paddling toward him. What came next was quite a surprise. "You are prisoner!" The man was pointing a gun at him. Davies's revolver was at the bottom of the sea. "Who the hell are you?"
"I am Major Alexander Georgievich Chapayev, Soviet Air Force."
"Howdy. I'm Commander Gus Davies, U.S. Navy." "Who got you?"
"No one get me. I run out of fuel."
He waved the gun.
"And you are my prisoner."
"Oh, horseshit." Major Chapayev shook his head. Like Davies, he was in a near state of shock from the stress of combat and his close escape from death. "Hold on to that gun, though, Major. I don't know if there are sharks around here or not."
"Sharks?"
Davies had to think for a moment. "The code name for that new Russian sub."
"Akula. Akula in the water."
Chapayev went pale.
"Akula?"
Davies unzipped his flight suit and tucked in his injured arm. "Yeah, Major, this is the third time I've had to go swimming. Last time I was on the raft for 12 hours, and I saw a couple of the goddamn things. You got any repellent on your raft?"
"What?"
Chapayev was really confused now.
"This stuff."
Davies dipped the plastic envelope in the water.
"Let's rope your raft to mine. Safer that way. This repellent stuff's supposed to keep the Akula away."
Davies tried to secure the rafts one-handed and failed. Chapayev set the gun down to help. After being shot down once, then surviving an air battle,
the Major was suddenly obsessed with the idea of being alive. The idea of being eaten by a carnivorous fish horrified him. He looked over the side of the raft into the water.
"Christ, what a morning," Davies groaned. His wrist was really hurting now.
Chapayev grunted agreement. He looked around for the first time and realized he couldn't see land. Next, he reached for his rescue radio and found that his leg was lacerated. The radio pocket on his flight suit ripped away in the ejection.
"Aren't we two sorry sons of bitches?" he said in Russian.
"What's that?"
"Where is land?"
The sea had never looked so vast.
"About 25 miles that way, I think."
"That leg doesn't look too good, Major."
Davies laughed coldly. "We must have the same kind of ejector seats. Oh, shit, this arm hurts."
"Damn, what do you suppose that's all about?" Edwards wondered aloud. They were too far away to hear anything, but they could not miss the smoke rising from Keflavik. A more immediate concern was the squad of Russians now at the base of their hill. Nichols, Smith, and the four privates were spread out across a front of 100 yards centered on Edwards, faces darkened, mainly squatting behind rocks and watching the Russians half a mile away.
"Doghouse, this is Beagle, and we got trouble here, over."
He had to call twice more to get an answer.
"What's the problem, Beagle?"
"We got 5 or 6 Russians climbing our hill. They're about 600 feet below us, half a mile away. Also, what's going on at Keflavik?"
"We have an air attack underway there. That's all I know at the moment."
"Keep us posted, Beagle. I'll see if I can send you some help."
"Thank you. Out."
"Michael?"
"Good morning. Glad one of us got a decent night's sleep."
She sat down beside him, resting her hand on his leg, and the fear subsided for a moment.
"I'd swear I just saw some movement on the top there," the platoon sergeant said.
"Let me see." The lieutenant moved his powerful spotting glasses on the peak.
"Nothing. Nothing at all. Maybe you saw a bird. Those little puffin things are all over the place."
"Possibly," the sergeant allowed.
He was starting to feel guilty for sending Markovsky up there. "If this lieutenant had half a brain," he thought, "he'd have sent a larger force, maybe led it himself, like an officer should."
"The airbase is being heavily attacked."
"Have you radioed in?"
"Tried to. They're off the air at the moment." There was concern in his voice. 60 miles was too far for the small tactical radios. Their heavy VHF set reported into the airbase. As much as he wanted to be with the patrol, the lieutenant knew his proper place was here.
"Warn Markovsky."
Edwards saw one of the Russians stop and fiddle with his walkie-talkie.
"Tell him he's climbing the wrong hill. Tell him to come home to Mama."
"Keep your head down, babe."
"What is it, Michael?"
"We got some people climbing this hill."
"Who?"
There was concern in her voice.
"Guess."
"Skipper, they're coming up for sure," Smith warned over the radio.
"Yeah, I see that.
Everybody got a good place?"
"A lieutenant, I strongly recommend that we let them get in very close before opening fire," Nichols called.
"Makes sense, Skipper," Smith agreed on the same circuit. "Okay. You got ideas, gentlemen? I want to hear them right away." "Oh, yeah, I've called in for some help. Maybe we can get some air support."
Mike pulled back on the charging handle of his rifle to make sure a round was chambered, set it on safe, then put the M16 down. The Marines had all the hand grenades. Edwards had never been taught how to use them, and they frightened him.
"Come on, fellas, just go the hell away and we'll be glad to leave you alone."
They kept coming.
Each paratrooper climbed slowly, rifle in one hand, and the other hand grabbing or fending off rocks. They spent their time evenly looking up toward Edwards and down at their footing. Mike was truly frightened. These Russians were elite soldiers.
So were his Marines. But he was not. He didn't belong here. The other times he'd faced Russians, in Vigdis's house, the terrifying incident with the helicopter, all those were behind him, and for the